quitting my job and I'm going to start working for myself.
Most contractors don't plan to sell their business.
If you're going to sell your business, you have to make sure that you're accounting for everything.
He's a multi-time entrepreneur who's been on both sides of the table.
You don't know what you don't know at the beginning.
He's built and sold his own companies, including a business he intentionally designed to exit.
Most businesses fail, but it's about getting back up.
This is AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros, the show for contractors who want to grow without wasting time or money. If you're in roofing, HVAC, plumbing, or any home service business, we break down how AI and modern marketing can help you book more jobs, close more leads, and build a business that runs without babysitting every task.
Most contractors don't plan to sell their business. And that's exactly why they're unprepared when life forces the decision. Today's episode is about optionality, building your business so you can sell it, even if you never do. My guest today is Alex Brown, Director of Business Development on the West Coast for Exit Stage Advisors. Alex isn't just an M&A advisor. He's a multi-time entrepreneur who's been on both sides of the table. He's built and sold his own companies, including a business he intentionally designed to exit long before it was trendy to talk about exits. In this conversation, we get very real about why every contractor should run their business as if they might need to sell tomorrow. What buyers actually look for beyond EBITDA, why owner dependency quietly kills value, how marketing systems and clean financials directly impact valuation, the biggest mistakes owners make when private equity or competitors start calling, why sharing the wrong information too early can cost you millions, how AI, CRMs, and technology are no longer optional if you want a premium exit, and why most owners regret selling, not because they sold, but because they didn't plan for what comes next. Alex Uxel breaks down what's really happening in the home services M&A market right now, and why buyers are still aggressively looking for well-run companies in fragmented industries. This episode isn't about convincing you to sell. It's about building a business that gives you leverage, protects your family, and keeps your options open, no matter what the future throws at you. If you're a home service owner doing real revenue and thinking about growth, risk, or long-term value, this is a conversation you need to hear. Let's get into it. What's up, guys? I'm super excited to have you guys on. I'm here with Alex Brown. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mauricio. So good to be here.
Yeah, so I'm super excited to talk to you. We had a great conversation a few weeks ago. I know you were at a conference and really excited to get to the things that we talked about. Before we get to that, I want to hear a little bit about your story, because it's pretty interesting. Tell me a little bit about your background.
Yeah, my personal background or just Exit Stage Left Advisors?
Yeah, personal, and how did you get into this industry?
Yeah, no problem. So I'm an entrepreneur. I actually started, like many people did. I went to college and got a degree in history, minored in political science, and now do nothing even close to those degrees. I thought about being a lawyer, a teacher. I had all sorts of different things and then fell into sales. So my journey is kind of interesting. Started out working for my parents. My dad's been an entrepreneur his whole life. He's literally never worked for anyone else since he was 19 years old. They had a sports marketing company. Both my older brother and myself went to work for him straight out of college. Amazing experience. You know, and I'm sure a lot of people listen to your show, especially in the home services industry, you might be that generation too that's taking over mom and dad's business. A great experience to have. Worked there for about 5 years and then had the bug to try something different. The business that he had started was really just kind of running its course at the time. It had a lot of customer concentration. Of course, now that I do what I do now, and now that I've been in business for many years, wish I would have thought a little bit differently, but that business ended up sunsetting. We started another business for him at the time, which was a vinyl record distributorship. It's called My Music Fix. Still around, runs it out of his home. And again, just the consummate entrepreneur he is, always just dabbling, loves to just deal with customers, loves to keep selling. From there, got into sports marketing, went to go work in sports radio in Atlanta, very entrepreneurial as well, privately owned radio station, really ran your own business inside of it. Did that for 5 years, about 7-8 years into advertising sales. I just knew there was nothing going on here anymore. I didn't know where to go with it. I was doing very well, made good money. Things were, you know, I'd say in a good spot, but I just felt the pull to do something on my own. And at that particular point, got involved with a few other people and decided that I was just gonna start becoming an entrepreneur. Literally came home from work one day, told my wife, hey, I'm quitting my job and I'm going to start working for myself. Thankfully, she's very cool and was okay with that, especially with you two young boys at the time. So first endeavor was software as a service. We had an e-learning platform. It was very exciting. We're on kind of the cutting edge of what was taking place at that time. This is like 2012, 2013. When ended up going and investing in some carpet cleaning franchises, which I still own today. And then also went to go work as a product manager for a different software as a service startup. And we were building Salesforce applications. We were actually the number one Salesforce application on the ecosystem there in the AppExchange. From there, I had the wild idea to get into the cannabis space. So in California at the time, there was a path to legalization that was starting to take place. My brother-in-law is a lawyer. So I came to him about 2015. I said, hey, I think this is something that we should be looking at. He had just gone through cancer, had found profound benefits from using the plant to help him through chemotherapy and treatments, and kind of blew my mind. And so we got into that business, ended up building what at the time was like a medical collective, and then turned it over into the recreational side, and then built a very strong business, was able to sell that company to one of the larger organizations. And about a year and a half ago or so, Ted Jenkins, who's the founder of our firm at Exit Stage Left Advisors, came to me and said, look, we've been doing this for about 4 years now. We've built an incredible business. We're constantly getting pinged from people about helping them exit their company. I need someone who's got entrepreneurial experience who can really identify with what it's like to go through that process. You know, I know you've had these conversations before, but not only what it's like to sell your business, but knowing what it's like after you sell your business too. You know, those are really key important factors. So came to work with Exit Stage Left Advisors and have been building out our West Coast operations ever since, and just absolutely love what I do. The M&A space is dynamic, but I just love working with entrepreneurs.
Do you know, like, if it's okay to share, how much did you sell your cannabis business for?
I'd prefer not to share, but you know, we were kind of in the early part of it, so you know, we were smart enough to run the business like a real business. At the time, there was a lot of people that were in the space, and they weren't thinking long-term and they weren't thinking scale. Where we really differentiate ourselves is just by doing what good business should do. You build contracts with people. You make sure that you have things on paper. You put everything in QuickBooks. There's a lot of cash going on in that space at the time. And there still, you know, is in various businesses, you know, even in home services, right? There is, you know, time where you might get some cash, but if you're going to sell your business, which is what we were building it to do, is sell it, you have to make sure that you're accounting for everything. So instead of just taking easy cash, maybe pocketing some, hiding some from Uncle Sam, we did everything just above board, and we built the business to sell the business. And eventually that's what we were able to do. But it was a good exit. It's a volatile space. It's now turning into quite a path, I think, for those who have had the staying power. A lot of upside in the industry long term. Still know a lot of people in the space. But you know, build it to sell it, right? Do the right things. And in the end, you're going to be rewarded for that.
So you sold to a strategic buyer, basically. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But that's what you sold to. Like, it wasn't like a PE group, just a strategic buyer, like a bigger company, basically.
Yeah,
like, okay. So let's talk about that, like that mindset you had, right? You started the business with the intention to sell. How does that change the way you run the business?
Well, from the very beginning, you know, when you're building a business to sell, you know, you're putting intentionality, you know, behind the business, you know. So I think a lot of times things just kind of start and you're hoping maybe, oh, well, I can support my family doing this. And those are all great thoughts to have. Every entrepreneur has this. But in the end, you know, we knew this space was dynamic. It doesn't matter if you're an HVAC contractor, you're a roofer, you own a pest control business. You know, it's important to think about where the business goes if you're not around, you know, so you need to build it from the very beginning as if it could go away tomorrow. You know, you need to know that this asset, you know, where your cash is really held, has liquidity, right? So That starts from the very beginning. Fundamentals, who's doing.
A quick thing before I get back to it. I'm hosting a small private workshop in Miami Beach on May 22nd. 30 contractors max. We're covering how to turn the leads you're already generating to actual revenue using systems and AI. The whole conversion side of your business that most people ignore. It's at the Palms Hotel, $297 to attend. And we review every application. If you're doing $2 million or more and you feel like you should be further ahead, this room is for you. Go to contractormarketingpros.net/event. Seats are going fast.
Talked about the other day on the phone. It's important for everyone just to, whether this is a business you want to sell or you don't want to, whether you want to sell the business or you don't, you should always be ready to sell it, because unfortunately life happens. You know, you could, you know, fall ill for, you know, hopefully that never happens, but you know, you get hit by a car or, you know, whatever takes place, you have a different life event, you might need cash. Everyone's cash is typically tied up in their company. So you want to put the right protocols in place so that you can sell the business. And, you know, that's a lot of intentionality. Again, whether you sell it or not, that's different, you know, but you want to build it to sell it.
Yeah, that's important, I think. I think most businesses have a life cycle. I think all businesses have a life cycle. Either they go out of business, which is the most common occurrence, or they get sold, which is actually rare, right? I think it's, we'll talk about that. Or they, I think that's basically it, right? Or they either go out of business, or they get sold, or they die, right? That's kind of the main things, right? So that's kind of like and most businesses don't really last a long time. If you look at the common life cycles of businesses, I was reading that in the 1950s, you look at the top, even big companies, like the Fortune 500 companies, I think out of the 500 companies, like only five of the like those companies in the 1950s are still around. It's actually like always changing, even with large companies. So that's the thing you have to consider. And typically with small businesses, mid-market businesses, it's led by the founder many times. And the founder is the one that kind of, and the founders, right, are the people that kind of drive the business forward. And if that drive is not there, the business kind of dies.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. I mean, and, you know, just sharing what I said about my dad earlier, you know, my dad is a very smart individual, very, has a lot of grit and hustle to him, and built a great business. And, you know, even though it was a good business and things looked really rosy, you know, he had large customer concentration, and, you know, things were going well, and he dedicated himself to that customer. And then in the end, regime change happened at that client, right? And a new group of executives came in and decided, well, why don't we just internalize what this outside resource is doing for us, right? So it never thought that would happen, right? Because most people, they have emotional attachment, you know, to that. There's loyalty, right? You build a relationship with something, you think that that's going to be reciprocated. But in the business world, that's just not, unfortunately, the way it happens. And I'm not saying my dad was naive whatsoever. It's just he got caught in a position where he was giving more than, you know, ultimately he received, and, you know, got caught on the short end of the stick with it. But being the entrepreneur that he is, and most of the people that listen to your podcasts, you know, he's able to pivot then, right? Okay, that one didn't work out. I'm doing something else. Because that's kind of the spirit of what entrepreneurs are, right? You know, something doesn't work here, I'm going over here then. Once you don't work for someone else, very difficult to go and decide to work for somebody else. It's just a different mindset.
Yeah. You're actively representing multiple roofing companies right now. Why is it that industry in home service in general, or if you want to talk about specific about roofing, still strong?
Yeah, I mean, roofing is one of the verticals that we spend a lot of time in, do a lot of deal flow in. We're actively representing about 9 companies right now, probably the most in this space. We like it, you know, one, because, you know, again, we love entrepreneurs. Roofing business, it's dynamic in a lot of ways. There's a lot that hasn't changed, but there's also a lot that is changing. It's highly fragmented, of course. You know, there's 100,000 contractors out there. No one really owns a big piece of market share. So there's a lot of organizations out there that have capital that they've raised and are trying to figure out how to gain significant market share. And just like in home services in general, you know, these are areas that AI is going to disrupt, but how is it going to disrupt it, and what timeline will it disrupt it within? You could have a myriad of different things that could happen over the years, But ultimately, you're still going to need to get your roof replaced, right? You're still going to need someone. I don't know if Optimus the robot is going to be changing out, you know, your plumbing fixtures, you know, very shortly, maybe down the road, but there's still going to need those types of services. And so they're highly attractive to buyers, whether it be strategic buyers, whether it be private equity buyers, whether it be family offices, because they have long-term endurance, right? And that's really what people are looking for. Not only are they looking to buy businesses that, of course, are predictable, but they're also looking to buy within industries that are fragmented. Roofing is one of those places where over the last few years, you know, some of that attention has really turned towards. So we like the industry a lot. We like the people in the industry. We were just at the International Roofing Expo, had a booth out there. Great talking with just a slew of entrepreneurs, good energy, great conversations, you know, so we just get along well with the space.
I read this the other day. I don't know if this is true. Maybe you can share some light on this, but I think the home service industry is predicted to grow like 46% in the next 10 years. Is that something, I'm sure you guys, something you look at overall, even though the last year and this year is kind of slow, like things are not really the best, like with suppliers and insurance, all those different things that have happening. Like it's still like, they're still, even long-term is still predicted to grow, right? That's like, that's what like PE is looking at, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, these are necessary things. You know, if you have something that breaks in your home, a pipe, you know, for example, or you live in a, you know, a really seasonal environment where it gets really hot or very cold and, you know, you need your machines serviced. These are services that you're going to dig in, whether economics are not going great for you at that time, but you're going to have to get these things fixed. You know, if you got a leaky roof, you know, you're going to need to get that fixed because you're going to want to mitigate potential other issues that could come about from not fixing the leaky roof. So these are the types of services that ultimately, you know, again, pest control, right? I ask this question all the time when I do speaking engagements, like how many times in this room has someone changed their pest control company in the last little bit? It might be $60 a month, but that's just like a set it and forget it because people don't want, you know, mice getting to their house or, you know, whatever the need is that they might have for pest control. But these are essential services in a way that even if maybe you've lost your job or you're in a tough economic, you know, time, you're going to find a way to try to pay for that just because you need those things fixed, right? So, you know, that's why it's so attractive.
Yeah, yeah. You said you entered the space 4 years ago. How things changed in the last 4 years?
I entered the space just a little over a year ago myself. The firm's been around for about 5 years. You know, I joined in just about a year plus ago. Last year we did 13, you know, deals in the space. And so we've got a lot of deal flow. You know, what's changed a lot? If we're talking about home service, 5-10 years ago, obviously HVAC plumbing was kind of, you know, a lot of roll up that's been taking place. It's been going on for quite a long time in that. There's still quite a bit that's taking place there. A lot of add-ons, a lot of buying that took place. And now people that maybe are still getting new into the space are looking to build a platform, but a lot of it are just kind of bolt-ons transactions at this particular point. You know, what else has changed? You know, I think you've talked about this in some of your other previous episodes that I've listened to, but, you know, the economy changes, the tax code, you know, changes. These things are not static, right? So under the Biden administration, this is not to be political. My political stance is all about, you know, how does it help an entrepreneur with their exit is basically my position. The capital gains was going to be proposed at, you know, nearly 40%, right? And then under this current administration, you know, you've got much more favorable terms in capital gains. How that changes after this administration, you know, you're gonna have to wait and see, but timing is a really key component to this. And when you exit, you wanna exit a number of different factors, of course, but also it is important to think about reading the tea leaves a little bit. It's like, well, if I exit now versus if I exit 3 years from now, what is the difference in what I actually get to keep at the end of it? Because it's not just exactly what you sell for, but what do you actually get to keep after the sale? So just following the trends, understanding where those policies may go is a really important thing to understand. And that drives a lot of this, the head and tailwinds within this space too, because owners are going to be more apt to think about a sale when they know they can put more money in their pocket post-transaction.
Besides EBITDA, like what are the most common things that an acquirer is looking for when they evaluate a home service business?
So after EBITDA, right, you know, of course, they're going to be looking at your numbers. You're going to want to have a business that, you know, is it a job for you? Is it a company? They're not buying you ultimately, right? They're buying the organization. So one of the first things they're going to look at is just owner dependency. And this is not mind-blowing insight that I'm giving you here. This is what everyone says, but it's very, very true. But that intentionality is really important here. So just what does your business look like? If you walked away for 2 weeks, you're down in South Florida, right, Mauricio? So one of the most beautiful spots in the country, right? So people are coming down there for vacation all the time. You get like, what, 40 million something tourists down to Florida a year. It's just an incredible spot. Miami's amazing. So all those people that are going down there, many of them business owners, how many of them are on their phone while they're at the beach, you know, popping back, you know, to the hotel room to jump on something to put out a fire, getting on the phone with a customer? What does that vacation look like for the owner? It's a really good thing to just kind of internalize, because that's what a buyer is going to look at. How dependent is this business on you? If you disappear tomorrow, what happens to the company? So what does your leadership look like? How are those leaders measured? You know, do you have KPIs? Do you have LPIs? You know, are you not only looking about what happened in the business, but are you also giving them leading performance indicators for what outcomes you want from them? How are you measuring that? Do you have really good systems in place? Documentation, for example, if X happens, how does someone know to do Y, right? Is it somewhere for someone to find that? What does training look like? So strong operations, strong leadership, these are really important factors outside of EBITDA. Your space, obviously, what is your marketing funnel, right? I mean, so kind of turning the table on you, because you see this all the time, but you know, this is a huge opportunity. If you're a better marketer, right, pure and simple, you're attractive. If your cost per customer acquisition is actually lower than someone else, and you've got good brand reputation, you've got good, you know, brand position within your market, and you've got really good paths of communication, referral programs set up, all very attractive, because a company is acquiring you, they would necessarily not like to recreate all that or try to build it from scratch. They'd rather tap into a marketing engine. What do you see on that front?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the end of the day, I think a lot of contractors are, you know, they don't understand marketing. That's really what it comes down to. And it comes down to lack of understanding. That's really what it comes down to. If you really take the time to learn and educate yourself on how it works, then you'll be much stronger from position and foundation to make good decisions. At the end of the day, marketing for small businesses, it's a mathematical equation, and it's not that hard to make money based for marketing. It's becoming more competitive because there's a lot more competition. A lot of private equity and private groups are entering the space and just putting more money into the gasoline. So it's getting more competitive. But at the end of the day, it's really about understanding what your numbers say. That's what it comes down to, right? Understanding what the numbers say, and then building dashboards that can help you understand what the, you know, how to market, how to attract your ideal customer, right? How to attract where they are, right? Where, how to position yourself in that way. Also the importance of branding, and branding is another thing that you have to look at. It's extremely important, especially in the day of AI, right? So understanding how that works, understanding putting it all together, and basically just kind of putting together a plan that can help you really achieve your objectives. And making a practice, it's like a discipline. It's like, you know, if you're hiring a sales manager or a sales, people understand the importance of sales. But the more you, for example, in roofing, the more doors you knock, the better you'll get over time. If you actually sit down and actually make sales, it's the same thing. The more you do it, the better you'll get over time. So it's making a practice and discipline. But in terms of for you guys, it's the financial people and private equity, it's about understanding what's your cost per acquisition, having multiple channels to grow the business, and having a strong brand. That's kind of the things I think you look at, right?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. You know, I mean, it's a massive part of it, and you know, out marketing in this space is very attractive, because there is, you know, there's a lot of people in the home services space, and you and I both know, I mean, just by searching, you might find some that, you know, maybe just don't even have a Google profile page that's built out, you know, just really low hanging fruit. And, you know, these are red flags, right, ultimately. And when they get into diligence, you know, these are the types of things that they're going to look at very quickly. And anywhere they see risks, they're just going to move on. You know, the other thing is having a close relationship with your CPA, very important, making sure that your accounting is clean, you've got, you know, really good process in place, you're categorized correctly. You know, again, if you're planning to sell and you have cash come in your business, pay Uncle Sam, you know, put the cash in to your accounting system, make sure that everything is very clean. You can't sell what you can't see. So really important that you know, just account for all expenditures. But having a tight relationship with your CPA, these are the types of things that, you know, I encourage business owners to do. Sit down on a quarterly basis, really work with your CPA. And if you have any, if you're growing your business, think about building in a fractional CFO. You know, if this is a soft spot for most companies, but your CPA really isn't your CFO. Your CFO is going to help you think forward. You know, so if you're trying to, you know, take market share, you're growing your business, you want to add personnel, you know, you want to maybe acquire another smaller player within your space. You know, these are the types of things that, you know, forward-thinking CFO is going to be able to look at your data, be able to help you optimize where your financials are and help you make really good decisions on the go forward. Right? Your CPA is going to be looking at the rearview mirror. It'd be like, what happened last year? And then how do we make sure that we, you know, get the best result out of it? So, you know, not confusing the two. You know, there's a lot of great fractional CFOs that are out there that, you know, you could have someone that maybe just works with you once a week. But, you know, really being sound with your financials is just another really important metric that someone's going to look at when they're evaluating your business. And again, they see red flags, they're just going to move on very quickly.
Yeah. And you said that when we spoke last time that the minimum that people, acquirers are looking at for EBITDA is like 2 million, right? That's what the minimum is.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. I mean, for us, we are sell side advisors working with, you know, entrepreneurs, founder-led businesses that, you know, typically have about 3 million of EBITDA to 20 million of EBITDA. That's our spot, you know? So, others might work with companies that might have, you know, 500,000 to 2 million of EBITDA. It's really finding your lane. Really about that is within that lane, you really start to understand, this is where we put so much time and effort, is understanding our buyer network. You know, we spend a lot of time connecting with our buyers, understanding what it is that they're looking for, because the more you get them and the more you understand the opportunities that they're looking for, the better you can be of service to your client. You know, ultimately that buyer network has power to it, but it really, you need to understand who it is that you're really selling to. And that's why it's important to have that, you know, that framework. And that's where you'll see people in our space that they might be, you know, lower market and they might be, you know, kind of lower mid market. We sit in that 3 to 20 million of EBITDA space is really where our power is. But, you know, a lot of other people are great in the market that's more like 500 to maybe, you know, a million and a half, 2 million of EBITDA.
Got it. Okay. I've read the book, you know, John Werlow is Built to Sell.
Yeah.
One of the things that he talks about a lot of the time, because he's out, you know, he sold his business and that's a podcast is all about, you know, selling your company. He talks to a lot of acquirers and a lot of people that have sold their business. And one of the things that he always stresses, this is something that also Vern Harnish says, I don't know if you know Vern Harnish from Scaling Up, that as a business owner, founder, you know, you're, unless this is your like, you know, multiple, you started multiple businesses, you start one business and this is your main business you've worked in. And this is going to be like the biggest deal, like typically that you make, might be in your life, might be. And you have to be very careful, right? Because what I mean by that is that the people that you're dealing on the other side are, this is like their 100th deal, right? Or 50th deal. So they're like, they have way more experience in that. So there's this disadvantage you're going up against, right? So how do you wade through that? That's basically that lack of experience and knowledge. That's the big thing. How do you, because one thing that they caution is that they actually do caution you to like not reveal all your information. Like in terms of, not talking about like the financial numbers, but like in terms of like negotiation, like you got to be like careful what you're saying and how you say it, because it can really hurt the value. So talk more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I'll speak directly to business owners because of course they're getting phone calls. They're getting, emails from people. It could be, competitor, could be, private equity company, could be family office. You know, there's different people that might be hitting that inbox. Nothing wrong. I always say, take the meeting, talk to them. If you have the time, right, make sure, because this is something that you're going to spend time doing, just make sure you're not actually diminishing your responsibilities within growing the business. Like we talked about before, you want to have a great leadership team, you want to be building a company that, is an actual company and not a job where you're having to touch everything, put out fires. So if you're opening up the idea of having your company to be acquired, you need to make sure that you're making space for that and it's not diluting your other responsibilities, right? Because you got to keep the company going. You want to keep the company growing because you're going to be in an even worse position if you take the eye off the ball. The company starts to flatten a little bit. That's going to be used against you. So make the time. If you're committed to, having some of these conversations, make sure you make the time. It doesn't take you away from your responsibilities. Be very guarded. You don't need to tell them really anything. They're going to ask you a lot of questions.
Can you give some examples of some things you shouldn't say?
Yeah, I mean, for example, they're going to want to know, they're going to have a guess, about how much revenue that you have. They're going to look at how many salespeople do you have? What is your online presence look like? How many customers have you serviced? They have ways of kind of understanding, of course, all this information, right? They can quickly give a profile. And then what they're going to try to do is get you to substantiate that, try to get you to maybe put your guard down. So they might give you out for lunch or they might say, hey, let's meet for a beer. And then they might start asking you some questions about, how many jobs do you do on a daily basis? How many do you do on a monthly basis? What's your margin profile? You don't really need to give them any of that information. I would always be turning the table and asking them, what are you looking for? Why are you here with me right now? What types of companies are you trying to acquire? How does my company fit into that profile? What does your fund look like? If I were to move forward with you, how would you buy me? Would you have to go get debt? Do you have cash to deploy? Quote unquote, like dry powder? But turn the tables. What you're doing is that you should be interviewing them, but they're going to try to get information out of you. So turn the tables on them, ask them as many questions as you can, give them very little about you. And then if you're going to sign an NDA or anything else that line, again, don't just do it blindly. Know what you're signing. If you have a lawyer, always make sure that you're bringing them into the process, understand what it is that you're signing, but interview them, take the conversations, because you're going to get to a point here where if you want to sell your business and if you're going to go it alone, you're not going to, I recommend, using a business advisor like Exit Stage Life Advisors. There's a lot of great ones out there. We're going to ultimately know where these pitfalls are, how to negotiate. And we're also going to take the burden off of you so that you focus on the business because it's a long-term process. The main thing is us protecting you from getting the maximization of your business, right? These guys are very good at trying to devalue where possible. Like anything else, you go to buy a car, you don't want to pay sticker price for the car, right? You want to pay whatever you can pay for the car, right? You get the best deal. It's the same way that someone's buying a business, right? So again, turn the tables, ask them a lot of questions, keep your information guarded, find out where they're coming from as much as you can, get a feel for them, and then figure out whether or not you want to dance a little further. But, I think a lot of people just have this sense where they want to know where their business is valued at. So they give them some information and not knowing that that information is probably going to be used against you now. And I don't mean that in a bad nefarious way. It's just business, right? It's just business and people are always looking for the upper hand.
It's like a poker, playing poker, basically.
Love that analogy. Exactly.
Yeah. How about if you're a business owner, right? I'm just putting myself as an example and I have a certain number that I want to achieve in terms of acquisition. If they don't give me that number, then I'll just walk away and I'm okay with it. Like that's cause I'm still running the business and I'm happy. Like, is that the right attitude to have, or should it be more like tell me more, like how does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, look, there's great places out there. And I mean, we, we can do it from a kind of street level market perspective. It doesn't take as long to look at your business and say, you know, here's where your multiple is probably falling within. Then you can have a professional valuation done. This is a great exercise, you know, to do for any business owners. Have someone come in and actually give you a real valuation on your business. You know, have that and understand it. You really, you know, if you're interested in selling your business, something you could do on an annual basis, I do recommend doing. It is an expenditure to do, but if your goal is to exit, have the knowledge and understanding of where your market is. You know, where are you valued at? So when you're not giving them the information, you know, that they're looking for, you in the back of your mind know really where you're valued at, and you can help kind of now turn the tables on that conversation because you now understand more or less where you're valued at. Really powerful to know, because people are, I can tell you, Mauricio, talk with business owners all the time, and people are, you know, we get generally about 38% more than the owner thought they could. However, we also speak with tons of owners who just have wild ideas of what their business is worth. You know, someone might say, oh, well, I think, you know, my friend down there, he got, you know, a four times, you know, of gross revenue, you know, and you're like, my God, you know, like that's unheard of. And if they got that, that is amazing. Typically, there's something that other friend really isn't telling them about the mechanics of the deal. Maybe a big chunk of it was attached to some type of egregious earnout that they're never actually going to get that money for. And it was just all some tactical, you know, ways to get the business to sign in. And then ultimately, they're not going to get paid much of that money. But understanding the value of your business gives you power. You know, so reach out to someone local in your community, local SEPA, you know, there's tons of businesses, you know, get a fractional CFO to come in. Someone to give you an understanding, more power in your court.
Yeah. Okay. So that's very interesting. That's very interesting. And in terms of evaluating the businesses, is there differences between the area, the trade, the years in business? Is that, you probably have like a matrix or something like that kind of evaluates this in that. Does it really matter? Like in terms of like a certain area, like in California versus Florida, I'm just curious. Does that matter or no? Oh no. Stuff like that.
It's a great question because it really just depends on, you know, who's the buyer, right? We have buyers that like rural communities for different types of businesses. We have buyers that only like major metropolitan areas, you know? It just depends on the business and then ultimately connecting them with the right buyer. You know, depends on what does that business look like? And again, what does the future of that business look like? You know, one of the biggest things that people talk about in this space is your TTM. It's your trailing 12 months. Like, you know, what is your last, you know, year, or, if, you know, we're in January, if it was all the way back to January, we're in February, but if it was all the way back to January 31st of 2025, you know, your TTM to all the way to January 31st, 2026. But you also want to be thinking about the next 12 months, right? Like, what does your business look like going forward? Because you're not just selling what happened in the rearview mirror. It's very important because they want to look at the predictability of your revenue over the last few years, right? They want to see that there is a steady state, hopefully a steady climb. But they also want to know, what does your pipeline look like going forward? You know, how do I know that this is going to continue on this trajectory, right? So you want to be strong with your pipeline. And kind of going back to whether it's rural or whether it's, you know, in a major city, you know, really just comes down to who is the buyer and then ultimately understanding what it is that, you know, your business should be valued at, and are you trending in a positive way? Because all these things help you just have stronger conversations with those buyers. But there's honestly a buyer out there for just about every business when it comes down to it.
How are buyers thinking about technology and AI adoption in the home service industry?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's going to be one of the first questions they're going to ask. You know, there's some great resources out there. I think you had Roslyn from AI Roofing Revolution on your podcast previously as well. There's a lot of really good people in this space that are helping people wrap themselves around AI. This is an advantage, right? This is a chess piece that you can move that a lot of people are really unsure about what to do with right now, but this is how you can take market share. And Mauricio, you know this, you know, incredibly well, just from the different businesses you work with, but you're seeing a lot of younger entrants into the home services market too, right? Younger business owners that maybe before were going to get their MBA and decided, like, plumbing business looks pretty damn attractive. I'm looking around my town. I'm thinking about the next 10 years of my life. Why don't I go that direction? The reason I bring that up in the context of what we're saying here is that that younger generation is just more technology adept, right? They understand these things a little more intuitively. So they're building their businesses from the beginning with these models in place, you know, using smarter ways to capture leads, to follow up with leads, building tighter funnels, right? So going back to what we first talked about, like what is your cost, you know, per customer acquisition, right? Depends on the, you know, space that you're in, but they want to see a tight cost per customer acquisition if possible. They'd rather not rebuild, you know, the funnel if they don't need to. But also just know that there's a young hustler generation that's coming up underneath you, and they understand tech and they're building their businesses with tech in mind from the beginning, right? So if you're not thinking about this, if you're not really adopting AI, there's some great resources out there. Again, I'll plug, you know, Roslyn from AI Roofing Revolution. In that space, she goes across all sorts of different home services verticals. There's a lot of good professionals in the space to lean on. You know, again, Mauricio, this is something you live and breathe, right? You got to get yourself around it if you're going to survive, because it's not a trend. This isn't going away. You know, this is only going to just help businesses create a better mousetrap. And these are all things that help just build value.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I looked at. So in terms of private equity, I read that the top 100 roofing companies, and I'm sure it's the same in other home service, the top 10 companies, 7 are private equity of the top 10. So they, and the, one of the things they said about growing the business, one of the main levers besides marketing and acquisitions is technology, right? Technology. How to really optimize, make it more efficient, how to use that to your advantage, because it's, even today is still far behind, I think, and it's still changing. I think it's still changing. It's going to continue to change, and it's about kind of embracing that, and I understand my experience working with a lot of these guys is that they don't have, they're not really computer people. What I mean by they're not sitting behind the desk, they're not going to be doing that typically. It's not, and it's hard to understand that, but at the end of the day, it's kind of sitting down and not doing it. It's like, it's, if you're going to do it, you're going to learn it. You just got to do it. You know, it's just kind of like, you're going to do it. You know, what are you going to do?
Well, it's the same thing. You know, we could kind of, you know, branch into, do you have a CRM system as well? Right. You know, and as you know, most of the people in this space don't have a CRM system. There's great systems that are out there. They are cost centers, but it's just like anything else. If it's an empty box, you're not going to get a lot out of it. But if you're putting the right stuff in that box becomes dynamic. You know, now all of a sudden you know a lot of information about your funnel, about who you're reaching out to, how you optimize your process. And if you're going into the stage of being acquired, again, these are all like bullets, so to speak, right? You know, you want to know all these different components, because if the more you understand your business, the more likely you are to be an attractive, you know, acquisition partner, because you can show what's not only happening, why it's happening, you know, why your margin profiles are this way, but also that predictability factor of like why the next 12 months looks better than the previous 12 months. But CRM systems is something that I know we both see quite a bit, just from, again, coming back from International Roofing Expo, speaking with tons and tons of owners, and you know, not very many of them actually have any type of CRM system that's implemented. And I think that's another one that you know, is kind of a blind spot within the home services industry.
Well, not only having a CRM, but using it correctly, right? Using it correctly, setting it up, you know, if you look at other industries, I mean, look at Salesforce, which is the largest SaaS company in the world. They actually have an entire ecosystem just devoted to their business, and they have entire huge businesses that are just created off their ecosystem, right? $1 billion companies, and they have, it's so complicated that a lot of people that they had to hire other companies just to implement it for their business. So just think about that, like how important that these guys, these people are willing to invest right into that, into making a difference and impact, right?
Well, as I mentioned previously too, Mauricio, like I was a product manager and I was director of enterprise sales at a startup called Cirrus Insight years ago, great company. And this problem that we were solving was Salesforce adoption. So we were the first company that really merged Gmail with Salesforce, you know, so most of these CRM systems, to your point, it's kind of an empty box, right? You're not putting stuff in there. So then it's not really doing anything. And now you're questioning, why am I spending this money on a monthly basis? You know, what is it doing for me? Well, there's great integration tools that are out there for pretty much every CRM, but make it easy for your salespeople to use the CRM. You know, make it easy for your organization. You know, find the integration so that there's automatic just captures. So if I send an email, it's just rolling straight to the contact, right? If I need to update something, I don't need to move between interfaces, but I can just do it directly from my Outlook or Gmail account. Like, make it as easy as possible. If they're mobile, you know, of course they have a mobile application for that, but make it easy for your salespeople to use and then build it out gradually. Like, you don't need to have all these custom fields immediately. Let's just walk a little bit, start using the CRM system, start capturing the information that's important to your cycle, and then gradually start to create some custom fields that maybe give you more nuance, more understanding of that cycle. But, you know, adoption is a major problem within CRMs. You know, so when you're thinking about implementing a CRM, think about it from, are my guys and gals going to use this? You know, and then if not, what are the hindering forces to them doing so? What tools do you have, CRM company, to ensure that my team is adopting this software that I'm paying for? But it's a question that you don't hear very often, and it's part of the problem why they fall flat all the time.
Yeah. And I want to talk about what happened after the sale, like for you, like how did that happened, like, you on a personal level? Like, did you have something that you wanted to do right afterwards, or how, did you take a break? How did it work?
Yeah, I was probably a little naive to the process, honestly. So I took a break. I had two teenage boys that were both in middle school at the time. And I thought, well, if I can slow down for just a moment in my life, this is probably the best time to do it. They're still at that age where they need me a little bit. You know, they're not completely independent in their own lives yet. And so I did take a little bit of a break. But most entrepreneurs, you get antsy after a little bit. You know, but I wasn't forward thinking enough about what am I going to do next. And I got some really great advice from an old colleague of mine when I was exiting out. And she's like, you know, you should sit with somebody and talk with them about, you know, what you want to do next. And I just thought to myself, like, you know, why would I do that? How important is that? But like most entrepreneurs, you find that there's a bit of a void. Like, we like being busy, right? Like, you're the same way as I am. And we're entrepreneurs. We get up in the morning, like, I have purpose, you know, I enjoy it. I can't wait for the next day because of the challenges it's going to bring. It's just kind of the way that entrepreneurs are cut. So, you know, a lot of times when you exit your business, you're not really thinking about, you know, is playing golf every day. I love golf. You know, it's one of my favorite things to do. I just got back from a trip with my brothers in Palm Desert. But, you know, how fulfilling is that really long term? What do you want to do? So, you know, this is classically couched as, what is your wealth gap, you know, within your exit plan? And then what is your plan post exit? So a good way to look at this is, I'm exiting the company, or I want to exit the company. You should be meeting with your financial advisor, understanding what type of liquidity do I need post-tax in order to live off of or recreate my paycheck. Or if I can't do that, but I want to sell the company, what am I going to be doing next? Because you don't want to just roll through the process like I did, and like many entrepreneurs do, and you learn from that, not really having a real concrete plan about what you want to do after. It's like 80% of owners regret the fact that they sold their businesses after they sell it. It's because they just don't have that intentionality before they sell. So, you know, get into the mindset, you know, have a plan. The old adage, have a plan, work a plan, but understand what it is you want to do. How much money do you need, you know, in a post-transaction world? And then if it's enough money for you to retire, then what do you plan to do? You know, are you going to, you know, again, are you going to be playing golf every day? If that's not enough, is there a local startup that you want to be a mentor to young entrepreneurs? Are you going to dedicate time to your community through, you know, various nonprofit endeavors? You know, are you going to start your own? But, you know, having a plan ahead of time sure does make the transition after the exit a lot easier.
It's interesting. I think, you know, if I ever sold my business, I think for me, it's I think I would start another business. That's my thing. I think I would start another business. But I don't know what, but it's something that's hard, because like, if you build your skills, right, into a certain industry, right? And if you want to do something different, it's going to take you a little bit of time before you build the skill for that. So it's interesting because, like, there's a lot of stories about entrepreneurs selling their business and then they're regretting it. And then they end up in the same industry again, back like 2 years later. But thing is that every time you go through this process, you have more experience. And that's why people that have sold their business like multiple times, they have a bigger track record of success. It's like playing baseball. These guys that are hitting home runs, they know what they're doing the third, second, and fourth time, right? That's why Elon Musk is like, you're not Elon Musk, but somebody like that is the guy who's started multiple businesses, and you know, like the next one he starts is probably going to be successful because he has the track record success of bringing that talent and the intelligence and the fortitude, just knows how to do it, right? So you know how to do it the second time. Right. So it's typically easier to realize.
Sometimes the first time and the mistakes that you make it so that second time is astronomically better than the first. I mean, I talk with entrepreneurs like you do all the time that first time they fell on their face, you know, that's nothing to be ashamed of, by the way. Most businesses fail, right? But it's about getting back up, getting back on the horse and giving another run. And that's kind of what the spirit of entrepreneurship really is. So, you know, to your point, whether you're exiting and you're looking for your next thing, or it might be your second time or third time, you know, trying a business, you know, just making sure you're learning from those experiences and then building upon those. You know, we've been lucky enough in our firm, you know, I sold my own business, of course. Our founders have sold their own businesses. Together, we've sold 8 of our own companies, you know, even before we sold a company for anybody else, you know, so. Having that emotional intelligence a little bit about what someone's going through, I think helps us, you know, in our process, but also helps us guide people and just make sure that they understand what they could expect and, you know, questions they should be asking their team, whether it be, again, their CPA, their financial advisor, eventually their M&A lawyer. But, you know, these are really important components to the process. And just again, as we said earlier, you know, understanding how much you need, you know, don't get caught in a position where you're selling your business and then after tax, this is not nearly enough money than, you know, that you wanted. Doesn't mean you don't sell the business, but have that knowledge ahead of time. Don't be surprised by it.
Yeah. And it's important to like kind of, yeah, you said you have a plan, be ready. And making sure that you understand what the next, it looks like you're basically helping people follow the same path you already followed. You did, right? That's what you're doing, basically, right? That's what you're doing.
So our other founder, Ted, had an amazing exit in his first company, built a financial firm, had about $3 billion under asset management and sold it to a New York private equity firm. His old firm was called Oxygen Financial. And, you know, he's one of the brighter people maybe I've ever come across, just a very gifted entrepreneur. And he will candidly tell you all the mistakes that he made in the first, you know, go around when he sold that company, things that he wish he could go back and maybe do differently, maybe left some money on the table. But, you know, you don't know what you don't know at the beginning, right? You know, now we've done, you know, countless amount of transactions. So you see it from the other side of the table, but it is important to kind of have that sting a little bit, you know, some of the best, you know, times in your life, you know, from, you know, just getting a little bit stung, you know, like, oh, I wish I knew that previously, but it helps you just become a better advisor. Nothing wrong with, you know, I would call them making mistakes. I mean, these are wins ultimately when you sell your business, but, you know, that's ultimately why, whether it be us or, you know, a million other, you know, different advisors out there, you know, try to find someone who knows what they're doing around the space, because there's just a lot of lessons that are learned and a lot of ways to just protect yourself, you know, through the process.
Yeah. Alex, where do people find you?
Yeah. So, ESLAdvisors.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. Of course, I post quite a bit of content. Everything I post is about just trying to educate business owners, whether it be, you know, interacting with people like yourself or other people that are experts, you know, within their fields. So I'm constantly trying to just educate, do a lot of different speaking engagements as well. But we put a lot of content out. So you can follow us at ESLAdvisors.com. We have a newsletter we put out every week, which is Eggs, Bacon, and Business. You know, again, we're just here to be an educational resource ultimately, right? You know, you never should convince someone to sell their business. That's not our job. Our job is that if you are committed to selling your business, we can help you. But You never want to convince someone to sell. You just need to educate, show them what's out there, hopefully guide them to make the right decisions, whether they're going to go it alone or with another broker. That's really all we care about is we care about entrepreneurs having good exits. And, you know, we're just here to educate and put out content that hopefully reinforces that.
Alex, thank you. Thank you for your time, man. It was a pleasure.
Maurice, it's so good to connect with you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to AI and Marketing for Home Service Pros. If you got value from today's episode, do us a favor. Follow the show, share it with a contractor friend, and leave a quick review. Want help using AI or smarter marketing to grow your business? Head to contractormarketingpros.net and book your free strategy call.